Welcome, everyone, and thank you very much for coming to this Adelaide Writers Week event. My name's Sian Kane. I'm the Deputy Culture Editor for The Guardian Australia, and I'd like to just start and say that we are gathered on the lands of the Kaurna people, and sovereignty was never ceded, and I'm deeply grateful to be here on their lands. I'm actually from Adelaide myself, so I'm particularly pleased to be here for Writers Week. It's such a great festival, and it's so wonderful to see you all here today. The festival does such a good job of assembling really interesting writers, and I've got the great pleasure of introducing you to one right now. Dr. Madison Godfrey is a poet and educator who currently works as creative writing lecturer and tutor at Curtin University in Perth. They have published two collections, 2018's How to Be Held and their latest, which is Dress Rehearsals, a memoir made of poetry, which was published last year. Now, I think that subheading is quite crucial today because this is a deeply personal collection and it covers Madison's relationship with their body and with love and desire and particularly with gender. Please welcome them today. Now, I like to use these talks as a sort of introduction to a writer and to a book, and to take you through a little trip through the book if you haven't yet read it. It sort of doesn't matter, you know, this is for everyone. So this collection is divided into three parts, so I think we'll proceed sort of through the ideas that Madison writes about almost in a chronological way. So Madison, would you mind reading us a poem from the first part?
Yeah, I'm actually going to read you the first poem of the book. Thank you for that lovely introduction. I also want to take a note to mention that all of these poems were written on Whadjuk Noongar Boodja. I'm from the other side of this country in Western Australia, and I'm really grateful to be here today. I also want to pay respects to First Nations elders and storytellers who are the traditional owners of this land and also of story. This poem is called When I Grow Up, I Want to Be the Merch Girl. For those of you who don't know, the merch girl is someone who, at a gig, is the woman standing behind the table with the shirts and the CDs and the merch on it. And growing up, she was often a girlfriend or a partner. So this is When I Grow Up, I Want to Be the Merch Girl. Sighing like a swimsuit model who got fired yesterday. Boyfriend's band shirt tied on one side. Silver belly ring aligning with the trestle table, glaring at her Nokia, permanent marker forearms. Later, the merch girl leans over my sister's sink in the graffitied bathroom, smudges her eyeliner with precision, undoes her middle part like a top button. I don't know if she goes to school or plays an instrument, but I've seen her fit a man's entire tongue in her mouth without flinching. I want to advertise Gildan shirts and burnt CDs. Want to look grown up enough to trust with the metal box. Want to angle my hips like armrests. Want my shoulders mapped by the longitude of lacy straps. She's always adjusting a bejeweled handbag while my backpack bulges with a water bottle and a Glad Wrap snack. When I grow up, I want a man to ask me to sit behind his pride while he sings about my thighs to a room of girls with black gauze turning their legs into ladders, blinks with only one of his eyes.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
So for anyone that hasn't yet read this collection, the merch girl is quite an important figure in this. And it was really interesting speaking to you recently because you said that you felt actually a lot of people that speak to you about this collection don't really acknowledge your love, your very clear love for music, which
yeah.
is sort of running all through this.
Absolutely. Collection. Yeah, I chose that poem to be the first of the collection because I like the idea that the first poems of poetry collections open 100 doors that you don't know you're going to walk through yet. And so I like introducing the book with that poem because I think it does that in many ways for many different people in different ways. The merch girl as this figure I grew up looking at and wanting to be is really interesting to me because I grew up in these live music venues. A lot of the time I was one of the only young feminine people in those spaces. and I was notable for my youth and for my femininity. So I was going to these gigs at my local venue, an underage venue, papered with posters, no light, like a black box venue where I live in WA. And those were the rooms where I felt most powerful, and I learnt lyrics and I learnt punk, and it was kind of my kind of entry into this culture and this history of the Riot Girl movement and those kind of ideas. And also it was this place of immense disempowerment, of feeling really vulnerable, of feeling really small, despite the fact that it's also where I felt large. And I think that dichotomy is throughout the whole book. The Merch Girl herself, as well as this figure I wanted to grow up and be, was so identified by her relationality to men, was so identified by the fact that she was the girlfriend or she was the, and I say this very much in air quotes, like the pretty, like, what is it, arm candy is the word? Like she was never recognized for her talent, for her voice, for her incredibleness. She was recognized as accompanying a man with a musician, who was a musician, a man with a musical instrument, and that man always had the voice. Mm. And so, you know I look very young. I know I'm young in the scope of many people's experience of time. And yet this was 15 years ago, a time where we think we've moved on with feminism, a time where we're seen, you know, people call that post-feminism, which I do not agree with. We still need feminism so much. We're not done at all. However, you would think it would be better, and it just wasn't. And it took so long for me to see women and non-binary people and angry feminine people on stages and headlining stages.
Mm.
Yeah.
It's so interesting what you say about power, because you know, there's been such a conversation, obviously, with Taylor Swift being in the country and just sort of this huge cultural sway that her fans hold.
Yes.
And that, you know, for the most part, her fans are either younger women or, you know, young queer people.
Yeah.
For the most part. And you can even sort of go back to, you know, Elvis and the Beatles and, you know, the huge power that, you know, sort of young fans, particularly young feminine fans, had, but also how pejoratively they were often spoken about, that their tastes were often rubbished, while also, you know, kind of being the driver between what got to the top of the charts. And
absolutely, yeah. There's a lot of writing about the fact that young groups of young female fans make the music industry. Like, in so many ways, they are spending the money, they are buying the merch, they are dedicated to fandom in this really intense, really obsessive way that gets called hysteria, right? And it gets categorized as hysteria. And the word hysteria is linked to this long history, which comes from like Greek ideas of the womb being wandering around in the body and like not being a tethered organ and it pressing against the body in ways that make you illogical and emotional and incapable of reason. And so when we think about fans as hysterical, it's actually, we're saying like, we don't believe in them as powerful. But like, fan money is money. Mm. Fan money does build industries. And we've seen that with Taylor Swift and her massive impact economically as well as culturally. Mm. Yeah.
Are there links, do you think, between your love for music and becoming a poet? Because you could make sort of pretty obvious links between, say, lyric writing and poetry.
Both of my books have a dedication in the back, in the acknowledgement section, to a band called La Dispute. They're a band from Grand Rapids in Michigan. They are a post-hardcore band. My mum would say screamo. They're not screamo. They don't scream. They like enthusiastically speak loud. You know, it's more, it's closer to poetry than screamo or metal or those sort of genres. It's just loud. Mm. And so I, in these rooms I grew up in, fell in love with this band, this random band who I just suddenly was like, they're my whole life and my whole identity, and I will never stop loving them. They are my whole heart. This was when I was 15. I've now been following this band ongoingly since then. I followed them around multiple continents. I have developed a friendship with them because we have grown up together and seen each other on every tour they have done, both when I lived in the UK and here. To the extent that, like, they've read my books, they're beautifully supportive of my books, and I think looking back at that relationship with fandom and that relationship with poetry, I often thank them for being the first band who taught me that poetry could be yelled and poetry could be really exciting and have a momentum to it. I hated poetry in high school. I hated it. And I now teach. So I now teach at university. I also teach high school students. And I teach like the romantic poets and Blake and these sort of ones. My cat is called Sylvia. You know, any poetry nerds will know what that's about. She's a sad cat. What can I say? And I love her. But also, I never felt included by poetry when I studied it in high school. I really felt like it included a narrative that like, didn't reach out to me, that I often felt like I was unable to understand, that I often felt like I was not intelligent enough for, or like hadn't, I don't know, touched enough trees to understand the whole romantic concept of Tiger Tiger. And so what I think about now is like, I think my poetry was born in mosh pits. And I think the way I use words, the way I use rhythm and resonance, and the way that these poems tumble out is really indicative of the ways that I felt in those spaces. And I think that's important as well. Not all poetry should come from university classrooms. And the moment it does, we are losing a whole cohort of voices that we really need.
That's so interesting. Do you see that in your students in terms of a shift in...
Yeah.
And I guess it must also be manifested in how you teach. I'm guessing you've learned some lessons from how you were taught yourself.
Oh, I'm a weird teacher.
Okay.
Yeah, and I actually teach the same units I hated. In my early years of uni, which I probably shouldn't say, but the same units I didn't love I now teach, and I really like trying to make them feel more alive. It's a real mission of mine to make students feel like they are smart enough to do these units, no matter who they are or what they did at high school or what they've read. Some people think it's about inclusivity, but I just get excited about it. I think everyone has a good story to tell if you give them the tools, and I think everyone has a great poem they can write if they feel like they're allowed to write a poem. And that poetry doesn't have to be a thing that you know what iambic pentameter is to write. You know, Shakespeare's great. He did some great stuff. He used the word they as a pronoun. He did it. You know, great job, Shakespeare. Thanks, William. However, you don't need to be writing perfect sonnets to be a good poet. And I think disrupting that for my students has felt really important. And it reminds me also that I do not have to write a perfect sonnet.
No pressure.
Yeah, no. There's no sonnets in this. Sorry. Some people are going to walk, stormed out, you know. The Adelaide Festival stormed out of my book and it's fine. There's one fake sonnet, but, you know, that's a longer story.
So many of the poems in this first part of the collection, because, as I said at the start, it is billed as a memoir made in poetry, so there is a lot of Madison's story in there. And you sort of write of your very early awareness at a young age of the ways being perceived as a girl or a woman would shape your life in the years to come, and also in the ways it was being shaped when you were a young person, that, you know, for example, not being allowed to walk to school, what sports you were allowed to play, even what parts of a uniform you were allowed to wear. And just that there was a throwaway line about... I think even about the fact that you didn't wear shorts meant that you've never learned how to sprint, which is just an interesting thing.
Or cartwheel. Yeah. Sorry, I've interrupted you.
No. I think that just if you...
Interrupt you with my lack. Yeah, I also can't cartwheel. Yeah, it's a horrible thing. I've tried a lot. I do like those weird bunny hops. I can do it later if you're at the signing desk if you buy a book, maybe. There's a poem in there called Uniform... which, funnily enough, so I'm very close with my parents. I'm an only child, and I'm very close with my dad, very close with my mum. In fact, we talked just before the session, and we'll probably talk after. They're very, very supportive of my work, despite not being literary people in that way at all. It wasn't a big reading house. I didn't grow up around books. And they've read both my books, but don't read huge widely. They don't really understand this era. They would think this is beautiful, but they don't really have that part to their lives. And that's great to be around. But they've read my books, and there's a poem called Uniform, which is literally about an argument I had when I was a child, in which I really put my foot down, and I was like, I want to wear shorts to school. Like, I was in primary school, and I was like, I want to wear shorts. This doesn't make sense. Let me wear shorts. Give me an option. And I completely lied about why. I was like, I want to cartwheel. I want to wear shorts because I want to cartwheel. I don't want anyone to see my knickers. This was a complete fib, but it was the most palatable reason I could give. I was like, oh, you know, girlhood is this thing of performing and cartwheels feel very aligned with how to make friends and how to all be celebrating on the school oval at lunch. I didn't want to do that. I just wanted to wear shorts. And there's a line in the book, I just wanted to eat lunch with my legs bent and spread, my crotch a glorious landscape of grey material, a body allowed to walk itself to school. So it was more about the permission that Shorts would give me to live a life that didn't feel limited by my girlhood and my experience of girlhood. And also, like, it just doesn't make sense, really. Mm. Yeah, I didn't even know what feminism was then, but there I was being like, give me my shorts. And they didn't give me my shorts, and so I still can't cartwheel. And that's, gender is the problem. Yeah.
There's a line in one poem, rage is a religion, something I practice in private.
Yeah.
And I wondered, did you know at the time that you were angry about many of these things, or did they just sort of all... I can imagine, you know, just even using my own upbringing, that these little things kind of build up slowly over time, and it's perhaps only afterwards when... you know, you've done a bit of reading and a bit of living that you kind of go, no, that was wrong. And
yeah, I think for a lot of my life, I grew up with a stay-at-home dad as well. And he called me in as a child in all our time together, half boy, half girl. Because I was always kind of beyond gender in a way that we didn't have language for back in those years, back 20 years ago. I don't know I was angry, because my anger and my rage were a mirror that I put up and looked at myself in. I wasn't allowed to be angry at other people. I didn't really understand you could be angry at systems, or that we are born into systems that we aren't aware of because they're so normalized. And so my anger became an internalized thing. I really didn't like myself for a long time, throughout my teenage years specifically. I didn't treat myself very nicely. And a bit of that is in the book, and I think you can feel it, although it's not always overt. For me, rage was something I felt like I didn't have a right to feel. Because girls are meant to be pretty and polite and palatable and good to be around and so friendly and smile on the street when you're like catcalled and be grateful for male attention. And so all of these things that made me feel small, I was told to feel grateful for. And instead of being able to express rage, I didn't have a medium either. Like, I loved writing, but not about this stuff, not about me, not about my body, because how boring. And so I think looking back, I can see that the rage, yeah, was a weapon against myself. And I think in writing this book and returning, and there's a quote in here from Tavi Gevinson, who some of you may know. She's done some great work around fandom as well and music. And she has this idea of, you pay a visit to the girl the memories happen to. And writing this book, as it was part of my PhD as well, which I've done, I'm a doctor, thank you, was paying a visit to the girl the memories happen to. And when I visited her, I was like, oh my gosh, she deserved rage. Mm. Yeah.
There's so many of these poems in this that sort of chronicle all the different ways that misogyny did impact you, and whether it was sort of the behaviour of people at live music gigs, but also even men in your family or men that you had relationships with in your teen years.
Yeah.
That you... Some freedom sort of came when you had sort of a level of freedom over your physical expression. So there's a line in one of your poems about shaving your head, the significance of shaving your head, and I learned to exist in public without treating myself like public property.
Yeah.
Which is really resonates, and I guess that's such a crucial thing that I think a lot of people only maybe discover, you know, perhaps when they're a bit older in their 20s, they sort of realise.
Yeah, I think I'm really lucky to work with young people who are so proud and so queer, and they become themselves, and I'm just like their biggest champions and their biggest fans. For me, I grew into my queerness very slowly, and it wasn't coming out once. I don't have some beautiful story where I like do a reveal of a rainbow leotard. Like, I wish maybe I'll do that later. But it was a constant coming out, and there was, you know, the coming out as maybe desiring women as well as men. Ooh. And then there was the coming out of my parents, and then there was coming out to community, and there was coming out in poetry, and then there was coming out as non-binary, and there was coming out as non-binary again and again and again. And maybe just then again for some of you. Ooh, surprise, non-binary. And so for me, like, growing into queerness wasn't one day waking up and feeling completely at home in it. Mm-hmm. It was a constant negotiation of self, and also like getting to meet myself again. Beyond girlhood and beyond misogyny, I hope, to an extent. There is a lot in the book about, so this is the first third as well. So this is very much about those formative years of growing up in girlhood and fandom. And I feel there is anger in it, and there's also this like reckoning with misogyny and this reckoning with male attention, in which I think I really was built to feel male attention or the male gaze as something that made me worthwhile, that made me sexy or successful or, you know, gave me comfort. I found real comfort in it. And the reckoning in this book that really happens, and the reckoning of writing it and also of getting to part three, was holding myself accountable for that. And therapy is great. And also, like, I think you have to reckon with that so you can love the men in your life as well.
Mm.
And to not feel that misogyny is, or like not feel that manhood is oppositionary to feminism. I often say the reason I'm a feminist, the reason I first became a feminist is because of my dad, who is the coolest dude. he is not, he didn't understand any of this queer stuff at all, but he is so great. And he was my stay-at-home parent, like I mentioned. And so I was picked up from school by this older man, significantly older than the other parents. Often he was told by other parents that he wasn't capable of being a nurturing parent. And he was given a lot of comments like that when I was really young. And it taught me a lot about nurture and caregiving as things that we always ascribe to the woman or the mother. And that kind of like puts men beyond this relationship and like gets a stereotype that men can't also be caring and nurturing and kind and emotional. And that's patriarchy. Like everyone is suffering under patriarchy. And so the reckoning was not just myself and my relationship with men, but my relationship with the patriarchal force that makes us all suffocated in our roles.
Yeah, that's incredibly tough. I think that's, I was going to bring this up later, but, you know, I think there's something, you know, I'm a cisgender woman, and I was assigned female at birth and I identify as a woman, but I find something so liberating in reading trans and non-binary thinkers, because I think there's, you know, such freedom that you can learn, you know, as a person who moves in the world, and you have a lot of baggage, and a lot of these thinkers really unpick the baggage that, you know, it's even, you know, thinking about, you know, men like your father, that can benefit from feeling a little bit freer about, you know, this is what a man does, this is what a man doesn't do, and actually there's such liberation to be found.
And that we all have to work for that liberation.
Mm.
Like it's not the task of one person. I mean, I hope we can all do the work in our own ways and think about our intersections of privilege and identity. But my dad works as well on himself, on his experiences of emotion, of his connection to all the systems that we're in.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, let's have a second poem.
Yes.
So this is from part two, and we'll speak about this after, but there's a character in this that's fairly crucial to this middle part.
Yeah. We did a quick change before, and I'm going to read the opening poem of this section, which I've never read at an event, so it's very exciting. It's called The Femme Fatale Appears. First, I walk in on the femme fatale in the bathtub, bent over like a freeze frame of a myth. It is Sunday, the day of scrubbing and wiping every surface until I can sleep soundly. I walk into the bathroom, and it feels as if a heat lamp has been left on. A substance, somewhere between mist and smoke, coats each cabinet handle. She has filled the space with something unworldly, something unspeakable, something soaked and aching and entirely hers. The room responds to her presence like a lava lamp to touch. One of her legs is bent, foot raised, her toes grip the porcelain lip, her body folded in half, an angle so awkward it could only exist in a fashion magazine. Her body resembles a body in a fogged up mirror. Her edges blur even after I blink, then blink again. Living alone has taught me to fear footsteps, but she is more apparition than intruder. She sighs as though she knows I am listening. Pastel razor held like a baton, contorting to make herself smooth. I close the bathroom door behind me, wipe the handle, blame the bleach. It was fun. Also, like, these poems, and the reason it might sound very different to a lot of the other work, if you heard me throughout this festival, I've been everywhere, but the reason they feel like they sound different is this sequence is, they're all together. So it's a poems that exist in sequence. It's almost like a short story in the middle.
Mm.
And I call it my surreal dream sequence. And so this first meeting is the persona of the book, kind of being visited by this figure of the femme fatale, this weird, like, haunting, kind of liminal, foggy figure of womanhood, or what we think womanhood should be. So they're very, like, quiet to read, And I think that's beautiful in a way, amongst the context of the rage of the first bit. Yes.
So how did you decide about the structure of this book? Because it's a, you know, it's incredibly, you know, that you can tell how much sort of rigor has gone into how the book is itself is structured. That you have this middle part where you have this character and sort of recurring imagery of, you know, mirrors and this figure sort of serving as, I guess, like a guardian angel.
Yes, in some way. Absolutely, yeah. Like a very, like, sexy, promiscuous guardian angel is kind of how I see her. Well, honestly, this second part, the femme fatale sequence, was written every night for about a month. I sat down and it was like being possessed is how I... It sounds bizarre to talk about, so just bear with me for about 2 minutes. Let me be weird. I felt like I had this thing that I was living inside of, and it was this strange figure who I'd never really thought about. I kind of had this question of, like, who is the patron saint of femininity? And then I had the end of a relationship in which I felt really limited and really restricted in who I was. I felt like I had stopped kind of being myself. Desire had left my life. And my desire for myself had almost left my life as well towards the end of that relationship. Fine person, bad relationship. And so after that, I had this like reckoning with also what I wanted from love and what I wanted from pleasure. And how I feel like the femme fatale has been this public version of femininity who's never allowed to go home. She's never allowed to menstruate. She's never allowed to be messy. She can't have her makeup smudged. She exists purely for, like, the male gaze of, like, mostly film noir historically and, like, all these representations of anxieties about women being too powerful or back to the old, like, Eve biting the apple. You know, that's all the theory of femme fatale goes all the way back to this strange myth where we blame women for their desires. And so this blaming of desire was something I felt really, really present with. And I had this very strange month, maybe month and a half, where every night I sat down and I wrote a poem. And really how they've come out is basically how they're in the book.
Huh.
Even the order. Yeah, it really was like being possessed.
Goodness.
Yeah, I don't
tell my... Has that ever happened to you before?
I always say that my brain is always cooking a poem. It's always like on the stove in the back. And they come out pretty much fully formed. Yeah.
Wow.
Which is fun until you're like trying to be focused on something and you're like, oh God, no, it's cooking. Like it's boiling. Everyone shush. I got it right, you know. It's not very like conducive to being in public. I feel like, yeah, there's always a poem on the stove in the back. And so they do kind of come out. I often refer to it as like vomiting or diarrhea. You know, it just got, when it comes out. And so, yeah, a lot of these poems were like that. But the femme fatale sequence and the world of building of it was new for me in the way that a whole world emerged that I wasn't sure or didn't plan or didn't know that I needed. Yeah. And I felt very nurtured by those poems as well.
Yeah, that's an interesting word, because I was wondering about what the significance of that second part holds for you, because when you get to the third part, there is a definite sense that there has been some sort of self-realization and that you're still learning about yourself and the people around you and how you exist in the world, but also there is a certain level of peace that you've arrived at in the third part that wasn't there in the first.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think of it as a before and after, that the first part is a before, the last part is the after, and the middle was, I feel like, there's a line in there, like, I come home to the rooms of my pleasure, I meet the ghosts of the women I was meant to become, and I thank them, kind of. It doesn't say I thank them, I do thank them, and then I let them leave. You know, I'm like, nice to meet you, maybe leave now. It's kind of this, like, meeting of all the women I could have been and realizing I'm not going to be any of them. And so the third part feels... I've used the word reckoning a bit, and it really does feel like that. It's a reckoning with femininity, both in how I felt it, how I enjoyed it, and how I felt small by it. And by the third part, it feels like I get to enjoy the juicy bits. The third part is an all happy poems, spoiler, but there is like a sense of the joy. When I was first selling, like in the meetings about this book with my publisher, I said I'm really tired of books about non-binary and queer people where we are expected to be always selling our trauma and our dysphoria. I've written about this a bit. I wrote about it for Refinery29 and The Guardian and those sort of places a bit. But mostly it's this feeling I have where if you're non-binary or you're queer, you're always expected to tell everyone how hard it is. Because it is hard and it can feel difficult, and we know that. And we know that from the rates of mental health with trans youth. And yet there has to be an option for joy if we're going to get through this, if we're going to survive it. And the idea that I could write a book about how being non-binary and being feminine and being a little emo kid who became a poet is not something that feels like a burden all the time. I also love my body and I love dancing. I love using my body. I love sitting here and speaking with you in this cool-ass jumpsuit. And so and the third part of the book felt like the place where I held myself accountable for my capacity to feel and embody joy.
Mm.
Yeah.
Oh, well, let's hear the poem from the third part, which is called Transmosh.
It's not the most joyful. Sorry, just whole like joy, joy, joy. And then I was like, well, yeah. Transmosh. Going back to the merch girl, but like I guess from this new reckoned place. My friend tells the gig photographer that Facebook has just started flagging her nipples as female. The vocalist is screaming the word vulnerable repeatedly. Their tattoos wink at mine like a private joke. Trans fans put the girl in Riot Girl. The guitarist has a string of fairy lights hanging from his backside like a tail. And if he tried to walk home alone, we would all become astrologers of dangling ass stars and make sure he got safely inside. My limbs sprout new hairs just to give the goosebumps something to latch onto. The vocalist still screaming, vulnerable, vulnerable, vulnerable. The band shirtless, the crowd a mirror. Man standing behind, oh, I want to rub the sweat of everyone I love into my skin like cocoa butter. Man standing behind me asks why I haven't taken my shirt off too. And instead of shrinking, I bite back so quick his masculinity tears between my teeth. It looks kind of nice there, kind of pretty, kind of femme. His appetite drips onto my Doc Martens where I stomp it out like ash. Glory be to the barricade of bodies like mine. Glory be to the punk music that stopped being about male egos wearing matching band hoodies and started being about the permission that lives inside my throat. Glory be to the prayer that sounds like a growl. Glory be to the congregation of the mosh pit. Baptize me in a spit that screams the same manifestos. If you kneel close enough to the altar of a stage, you can see it was never a holy place, but a place where you were allowed to feel holy.
So you said that's not a happy poem, well, not necessarily overtly happy, but I do feel like there is, there's a sense that you or the sort of the persona in your collection has found their people that, yeah, and also found themselves that can, you know, turn around to the bloke bothering them and tell them to rack off.
Yeah, and the things we said before about masculinity and masculinity, you know, having the potential to reckon with patriarchy, I think it's important that that doesn't mean that I still can't absolutely reckon with it when men act like that. Mm. You know, it's not a forgiveness, it's an accountability. Mm. And I think that's the change as well. It's not accepting what's happened, it's not saying it's okay, it's saying it's actually not okay. But this time I'm actually, I feel like I'm parenting the girl I was. And there's been so many times in mosh pits over the last 5 years that I have felt much older than I am, and I have held girls up and I have been the one in the bathroom and comforting them. And I do feel like a mum sometimes to the young fans.
Do you think that there has been a generational shift just in terms of how young feminine and queer people are treated in live music? Or has that just been, I guess, with time? Or do you think it's attitude?
It's better. It's better. It's hard to say it's better when I can think of so many examples straight away from the last year that were not better. And it depends on the genre as well. Like, I was growing up in these really like punk hardcore scenes. Like, I wasn't in pop. I wasn't in even pop punk. I was in these like gigs on the Sunday afternoon where it was all adult men. Mm. And so like even in those genres, I'm seeing change. Finally, I'm seeing more women and more trans people on stage than I literally ever have, and nothing makes me more excited. And yet, I think there is more work to be doing about the systemic ideas of who has a voice, also about whiteness in that space, about access in that space of bodies and their needs. And I think we're on the right path, but we're not there. Mm. And the idea that we're there is actually harmful. Mm. Yeah, like about post-feminism before. We're not done. There are still people who can't access those gigs. And the idea that we're done is actually so harmful. So yeah, I'm still angry is the answer to your question.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, we were speaking just before about how this book was put together, and you mentioned before about your relationship with your parents, and you mentioned, I did not know this until about 30 minutes ago, that your mum edited this book.
Yeah, so I had an editing panel this morning and redacted this. So anyone who was here, here's like the secret of the panel. So I do have professional editors, very much, very grateful for them. Both of my poetry books, before they've gone to print, my mum and I have sat down and gone through it page by page together. My first book, we did it at my local cafe. This book, we did three sections. We did one every day, 3 days in a row at three different cafes. Two big of those big binders. I got her an Officeworks binder. I bought her some coloured pens and some stickers. And we genuinely sat across from each other page by page. Like we did it at the same time, every line. Those of you who might know this work might be like, wow, there's a lot of explicit stuff in this book, Madison. Yes, my mum has read all these poems, including the ones that are overtly sexual and overtly grotesque. And she loves them. My mum is my best friend. Sometimes people say that's sad, and I think those people don't understand how cool my mum is. Her name's Sadie. She's a legend.
Shout out, Sadie.
Shout out, Sadie. And so I think having her, and she was an accountant and an auditor and a numbers person, and she has found an error in both my books the week before it went to print.
Ah.
Yeah, and I'll tell you that, because she'll kill me if I don't. And so, like, she is amazing. And I think being able to write something and share it with someone like her, someone who is so close to me yet so far from the poetry of it all, feels really special, because it's also sharing story and sharing narrative. And back to that idea of what happens if we make poetry something that anyone feels smart enough to read.
Mm.
Yeah, my mum has not done any creative writing degrees, does not a writing person, and yet she likes the book. She says it's good. My mum says you should buy it. And so Sadie says it. I'm just passing on the word from Western Australia. Yeah. I think if we think about, like, it's such a privilege for me to have my mum in the room where I write, the metaphorical room, and it's such a privilege to have her be here for this part of my life and to get to share my own reckoning with womanhood and gender with her and to have a relationship with her, which has been about her learning her feminism through me. It's just such a beautiful exchange. Yeah.
Because like you mentioned before that obviously you're both very game for doing this together.
Yes.
And you have that close relationship. But I also imagine there'd be quite a lot in here that as a parent you'd read this and you go, God, that's sad. Or I didn't know that that was happening. Or
yeah, there was tears when we read through this book the first time. There was from both of us. There's a lot of stuff you never want your kid to go through.
Mm.
There's a lot of experiences in this book that I would never want my kid or my students, which is, I don't have a baby, so the closest I have is my cat and my students, you know, of that care role. No one ever wants the people you love to feel small or to go through violence. And so, yeah, she does struggle with that, and I think every parent would. And I think she's also incredibly grateful that I have an opportunity now to articulate it and to get to this point, the third part, of reckoning and of having a relationship with myself that didn't just survive violence, but actually has learnt to thrive in a place where violence lives. Yeah.
Yeah, good. Yeah. And so when you were going through this, you know, at what level were you, you're going line by line with your mum?
Line by line.
That's amazing.
That woman loves commas. Yeah.
And is it like a very sort of like a mutual kind of brainstorming kind of relationship or?
No, she wants to find an error. She's hungry for it. And every time she finds something, she thinks, she's like, whoa, I got one. We got one. She's very, like, we're very like that. Yeah, so she loves the, she wants to find an error so badly. And I always say, like, I'll buy you lunch if you find one. So it's a very competitive relationship. Yeah.
That's great. So almost a year ago now, actually, that Madison wrote a really great piece for us at The Guardian, which you can go read online for free. It's just Google Madison's name. It was a really, really instructive piece, I think, because I think there's sometimes this misconception out there that people who publicly identify as trans or non-binary must be going through a transition, and that transition must be, you know, surgically based or, you know, hormone or medical as a procedure. And you wrote, "My transness is not about feeling uncomfortable in my body. It is about feeling uncomfortable with the gender that was allocated to this body."
Yeah.
I wonder if you could speak to, I guess, the point at which you realize that, because
yeah, like I said, I think it, like, coming out into queerness was not one amazing reveal it was 100 tiny reveals again and again, and a growth of this. One of the reasons I think that one of the things that article stems from is that often if I say I'm non-binary or I say I'm trans, I get asked a lot of questions about my genitalia. And I get asked them at festivals. I get asked them at signing desks. I don't know if you've ever had a line of strangers ask you what's beneath your underwear. And I don't know if you can imagine how strange that feels. And my funny answer is like, you could buy me a, you know, like, are you trying to hit on me? In which case, you know, kind of pitch yourself better. You know, I'm interested, maybe. I'm single, maybe. You know, like, come on. But really, like, it's really none of anyone's business what genitals I have or what I do with them. unless you're trying to get in there and then we can have a longer chat. This is not a proposition. I don't know who's here.
So is this a weird time to mention you'll be signing books after?
I will be signing books. Probably don't ask me about my genital, but you can ask me about my mum. weird sentence. Horrible out of context. Ooh, anyone who walked past, I'm a normal person. And I wrote that article because there's such a like singular narrative of transness or singular narrative non-binariness. And it comes down to a lot of narratives as well. So a non-binary narrative, this is what happens, or this is what a queer person always does in the films we watch or in the Netflix shows. And the same idea of transness is like a before and after picture. Like trans means transition. Or like people assume that trans is short for transition. It's actually not. It's short for transgender, which is a whole different word. And so you don't have to be engaging in a specific form of transition to be trans. I'm not a before picture or an after picture. I'm just who I am. This is not to say that people who medically transition or want to, I have no problem with that. Go, like, absolutely, live in your body the way you want to, and I wish it wasn't so hard for those kind of procedures or those kind of processes. I wish it was more accessible to those people who want that. But it also doesn't change my transness, the fact that I am not currently interested in that. And heck, one day I might be. And that's also potential. Mostly also, I think there's a real confusion about non-binary people being trans. Non-binary basically means I'm not a woman and I'm not a man. I'm a different thing. I'm non-binary. Different box on the form, if you might. And I call myself non-binary under the trans umbrella because trans means not identifying with the box that was ticked at birth. I had an F box ticked. I'm not an F. I'm a non-binary person. And hence I'm trans because I don't identify. But again, people seem really scared of this. Like people are scared of non-binary people or trans narratives because you're like, how will I ever understand? And I'm like, you don't have to. You just please be compassionate and please like listen and read some books. And you know what? If you want to read dress rehearsals, that's awesome. Like, thank you. But beyond that, this is not the non-binary narrative. This is one book by a non-binary person, and it's mostly about being a little bit promiscuous and a little bit joyful. And there are a bunch of books by other trans people who show different parts of identity and who explain their identities. Again, we're not like one. You don't read one woman's book and you're like, I understand womanhood. You know, you don't read Tim Winton and you're like, well, I understand manhood and I understand the ocean. Like, and the same thing, like you don't need to read this book and be like, well, I get it now because Madison said this. No, 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 we're all different. And I think once we learn to accept people for their differences in every intersection of that is when we'll start to make progress here.
Mm. Well, we'll go to questions really soon.
And we know not what to ask me now.
Yeah. Please no questions about genitals.
No, my genitals, fine.
just on that, I've been asked to just mention Adelaide Writers Week has a zero tolerance to racism and disrespectful language. I also have a zero tolerance to that. And if you're asking a question at the microphone, we ask you to keep it civil and remember it is a question and I will hold you to that.
Yeah. My mum is in Perth, but she will find you. Yeah.
She'll say it, you'll be able to say something. Just before we go to questions, though, I'll ask one final question because I think that throughout this book, you know, we've mentioned the merch girl, we've mentioned the femme fatale, you know, you are a non-binary writer, but there's also so much about womanhood and girlhood, and that it's essentially so much of the book, which I think is fairly unique. You know, I think that you don't often get to read stances like this, is that you have arrived at an understanding of yourself as being non-binary, but also that does not need to have to clash with any femininity that you express, that you, you know, celebrating your body doesn't make you any less non-binary. And the same for womanhood. There's this sort of perhaps like misconception that you must sort of forsake any kind of female quality to yourself.
Yeah. I one of the things I learnt while writing this book is that for a long time I thought femininity was something that made me weak. And because I learned that in the merch girl in those rooms, I learned that femininity meant smallness and weakness under patriarchy. And what I've learned now in life and through this book is femininity makes me really strong, and it makes me really brave, and it makes me really happy, and it makes me really sexy, and it makes me feel beautiful, and it makes me connect to my mom. And that femininity, there's a line in the book that says, you know, my femininity is not a survival instinct, it is a song. And I like the idea of the songs we hum to ourselves walking home, that we were told that made us like more vulnerable on the street, becoming a song that we sing to ourselves in the mirror before we leave the room. So that's kind of, I think, the spoiler of the book, is that I learned that femininity was actually so cool. And I learned to feel really, really confident in that. And so I get to sit here today and be like, I love my femininity. It doesn't make me a woman, and it doesn't make me any less non-binary or any less trans or any less queer or any less kick-ass. It actually does make me very kick-ass. And I hope that we can continue to teach, especially our young women and our young feminine people, that same lesson as we grow, as we raise them.
That's a nice one. What a lovely point to end on. We have a microphone just in the middle here, so if anyone would like to ask a question,
do it.
Please do. You know, it could be about anything, really. I feel like we've touched so many.
Oh, cool, red hat, yeah.
Excellent red hat.
Got red hat, then orange shirt. I don't know, you might just be moving, I don't know.
Hiya.
Hello.
Hello. Thank you. I love the book. And
thanks.
Thinking about the three-part structure, it's almost like thesis, antithesis, synthesis.
Wow.
Was the third part the hardest to write? Like, did you feel like you needed all the answers?
No. The first part was the hardest because it really took a visit to a place that I wasn't sure I wanted to remember. And I think it's really hard going back to a memory that you feel small in or feel vulnerable in and revisiting that and being like, oh, dude. The actual hardest part of the whole book was putting it together and realizing that the poems in the third part so clearly echoed the power dynamics in the first part. Mm. When it's a memoir, you don't want to see a narrative structure and you don't want to see echoes in your trauma. And yet I had to. And so like it was almost the third part felt fun to write. They were the last poems written in the book, and I really enjoyed them in a way, and they came out very fast because it felt like I was writing my current self, and that felt easy. I would go to a gig and then write after it, you know, like it was very like present. So the hardest part was seeing a chronology of myself and my youth put together so starkly and having to really sit with that and take that to therapy. Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you for your question and your great hat. Oh, another great hat. Great hat theme.
Yeah.
Hello.
Did your academic study of writing help or hinder you becoming what you're doing now?
Yeah, so I came up through performance poetry. I was a slam poet and a performance poet originally. And then I did honours because I came back to Australia after being a performance poet in the UK for a lot of years, and I needed money. So I did honours simply so I could pay my rent. And then it spiraled, and I've now done a PhD, and I teach at a uni, and I've got a fellowship, and I, as of this week, have an office, which is very bizarre for me. This was the creative product of my PhD. So I think it's also really exciting for people who are doing PhDs to be like, there is a mainstream outcome you can pursue or dream about. Like, there is an option for your PhD research not to sit in a drawer or behind a paywall for the rest of your life. Academia is weird. It is an institution built for people, by people who have a certain kind of energy and identity. And I think there is an interruption in this book where it isn't what you'd usually find in a university. There's a lot of bodily fluids in it for a university product. I love people who've just sat down being like, what has this panel been about? You'll never know. You can't explain it. However, I think what I love is the idea of research as curiosity. So often we think of research as a pursuit of journal articles and really deep, deep gender theory. But what if gender theory is also curiosity and a way of understanding how we move through the world and how we love people, as well as this idea of, like, you know, rereading Gender Trouble by Judith Butler 40 times? In that way, I think research helps because I love research and I love writing and I love ideas. And I think if you can find a way to make research about curiosity, not about institutional knowledge, then you get there. Does that answer it? Also, if you want to do a PhD, go do it. Screw him. Hello, not a hat, but still a great presentation.
Thanks. I'm just trying to get my head around all this, right? So you're saying if transness is none of everyone's business...
My genitals are none of everyone's business.
Well, I thought you said transness at one stage was none of... Yeah.
Keep going.
Why do you... I'm curious.
Yeah.
Why is your focus so much on this? Mm-hmm. Because it's sort of all sounding to me, and I... Yeah, this is just how I'm feeling it. Like, incredibly narcissistic.
Narcissistic.
In a way.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, because it's a little bit of the whole you.
A little bit of the whole me.
I would have thought.
So funny that narcissistic is the main feedback for my Guardian article. That was the main feedback we got, yeah.
When you were asked to write about yourself, it was narcissistic.
Yeah. So, because it's a memoir, it is narcissistic by genre. Many memoirs, I would say, are narcissistic by genre. It's a narcissistic genre. I am definitely looking at that river and I'm seeing myself and I'm writing about it, and that's the story of Narcissist. We've mentioned the mirrors in this, and if Narcissist mirrors are in this, we can see them. As I mentioned before, the part of my transness, I have made a choice to put into public knowledge. I've made a choice to write articles about it for popular consumption. I've made a choice to mention it in this book. But also, yeah, I do think still my genitals are nobody's business unless you're interested in getting to know them in an intimate way and we both consent to that and we can have a little, little romance maybe. Buy me lunch. I think transness also is... It's not nobody's business, but it is one part of me, and it's one part of this book as well. In our conversation on the phone about this chat, I was like, I really want to talk about music. And I really want to talk about desire and love. And I also say, like, this is a book written by a non-binary person, but it's no way a guidebook to non-binariness. I think this book is far more interesting when you look at it about fandom or about how we love ourselves and how we learn to love ourselves after violence of girlhood. Yeah. So you know what? If that's a narcissist, I'm a narcissist. But I'll take it.
Need a compliment for you. Great shirt.
Good shirt.
Thanks.
Here we go.
I'd like to answer that a little bit because I grew up like a tomboy, I guess, in the 80s. So I'm really excited that the book gives people permission to have a broader language about femininity. So that's not a question.
Thank you. That's a compliment. Thank you for my compliment.
That's a compliment, yeah. The question is really... because it's prose poetry, which is, and you read it in a very kind of spoken word way, I guess, which speaks to your spoken word history. Uh-huh. So my question is, did you have to work against spoken word? I mean, because I think your prose poems are still full of rhythm.
Thank you.
So. Did you have to work against that to write this particular book? So it's, I guess it's a question around that old thing of, is there really poetry for page poetry for stage, or is there a melding of the two that happened in this writing?
Yeah, I think before this, thank you, great question. So when this is my second book, my first book was published by a spoken word publisher in the UK. Very different. And when this book came out, I think people were expecting scripts rather than poems, you know, the sort of poems you'd hear. But these poems are quite dense. Like I said, they look like paragraphs. A quick note, because you've opened a door that it's very hard to close for me. The prose poem, which is my PhD is on, is the best form ever. And back to research, it's my favourite thing to talk about and learn about. And so research is just learning to love things again and again. And the prose poem looks like a paragraph, so it's like it just looks like a big chunk. And the reason I love this and I'm so excited about it is because when you see it on a page, you think it's a paragraph, and then you meet it and it's a poem. And I really think gender is the same. Like, you might meet me and think I'm a paragraph, but spoiler, I'm a poem. Like, you might meet me and think my femininity it means womanhood, but it actually means I'm a non-binary person and I'm feminine. It's like it's a poem playing dress up. And so I fell in love with the prose poem. And the reason I think there's rhythm in it is I love that the prose poem is tumbling. I love that there's the momentum. And so I think you can hear the still sonicness in the work because of that punk manifesto and that way that refrains kind of have this beautiful like resonance synergy to the quality of language. I think, if anything, this is more page poetry than anything I've written before. but I never want to write anything that doesn't feel like it's alive. And so that's kind of my understanding of how I approach the prose poem as a chunky little tumbling. It's a momentum for me. Yeah. So page poetry does exist. It just has to be good.
Which is a good rule for life.
Yeah.
Are there any last questions?
There was one person who just waved. I don't know where they went. I can't remember. You waved somewhere. Don't know where you went.
I might just make one last point.
Okay.
In regards to our last questioner's point at the start of their question, just about mentioning the term tomboy, which I think is like an interesting thing that I think I think we both grew up in the 90s.
Yes.
That that was still a term that was sort of labelled at young girls that, you know, perhaps acted more masculine than the families expected, and it'd be like, oh, you're such a tomboy, and I guess actually that feels quite outdated.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of pushback against the term tomboy now, which, you know, I agree with in some ways, and I also think is interesting because I think we should let women be masculine, and that doesn't mean someone has to be non-binary. Like, I think we can let girls want to wear shorts and it doesn't evoke queerness or transness, that we do not have to perform womanhood in the same way to identify as women. I'm not saying everyone is non-binary. I'm not saying if you want to wear shorts, I'm going to be like, oh, they, them. Like, no, really, it's not about creating another solid box. It's about questioning why we need these solid boxes to identify with people and to make sense of people. And so I think tomboy is another one of those terms that people have found their power in or have been disempowered by, and that's a really individual experience, yeah, and quite generational as well.
Mm.
Yeah. Hello.
Hello. Thank you very much for your presentations this morning.
Thank you.
And today they've been fantastic.
Ah, thanks to both. Super fan.
My question's about terminology that you just reminded me of. So you're just talking about tomboys. Is there it's pretty trivial, but maybe not. Is there a better pronoun for non-binary than they, do you think? What do you suggest?
There's a lot of options, actually, and there's like a bunch. I won't go through them all, but you can Google it, and there are not just he, she, they. There are like also neo-pronouns and other things as well, and some people use multiple pronouns. Some people don't like any pronouns. So there's like, really, it's a vastness of experience. I like they. I like, for me, and I think it's also personal. It's like, what's your favourite colour? Is it orange? Green. Your favourite colour is green, and you like wearing green, and you, I guess, would feel comfortable and like yourself when you wear green. Yeah? To an extent. Let's assume that. All right, let's assume. I feel like that when I have purple or black. They're the colours that make me feel most like myself. And for me, they is the one that feels most like myself, and I feel the most abundant and connected to who I am when I use it. And so I don't think there could be a right option or a wrong option. There are also non-binary people who use she, her, and he, him, and binary pronouns as such. And so instead of being like, thinking like there's a perfect option or there's a great pronoun, we should all use the same pronoun, I think it is about like what colour do you feel best in? And for me, that's purple. For me, it's having my hair long at the moment. And for me, pronouns feel the same. Like what feels the most suitable to your identity and how you move through the world as yourself. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
First of all, I just wanted to say congratulations, a wonderful vitality of your imagery.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Yeah. My question is actually about form.
Great.
You talked about the trilogy form of the whole work. What about each individual poem? Like, do you start with any idea of what might be the form of the individual poem, or does that just form itself organically?
I think forms are the vehicles that the stories live in, and every poem could be written in 100 different ways, but we find the one that has the most synergy with the topic to make it like work. So could I split these poems apart and make them lineated? Probably. Did I realise that the prose poem felt correct? Yes. And I wrote a whole chapter in my PhD about the prose poem as a mosh pit. And so like the mosh pit of like all the words pushing against each other like bodies and the way they kind of have that yelling. I'm a nerd. I love research. Curiosity again. When it comes to these poems specifically, I was so interested in the prose poem and I was so passionate about what it can do that I felt like I was asking myself, can there be a new like version of prose poetry that feels really contemporary and that feels really queer and that feels really almost like boundary pushing in the way that it takes up space? I think because this is such a book about taking up space and having a voice and growing into yourself, that the form of the prose poem, really, the way it takes up the page, and this is slightly bigger than a normal book, it's a little bit out on the shelf, it really takes up the space. So when I was writing this book, they all came out as prose poems. There was really no question for me, and they did come out in that fast immediacy that they just existed suddenly. There's a suddenness to the writing of this book, which I think is to do with the suddenness of the poems and the ideas as well. But yeah, I mean, I've written other things. I put lines in. I can do enjambment. I can do rhyme. Just not in here. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'm so sorry, but we are literally being moved out because the next session is about to start. Thank you all so much for coming to this session. If you want to speak to Madison, they'll be signing books over at the book tent. Please support all the authors. Buy as many books as you can for the next week.
Thank you for coming, and also thank you to Sian. And yeah, come get some books signed if you'd like to.
Yeah, come and chat. And thank you so much. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, everyone. And thank you to the techs. Thank you.